Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. Watch, chop, retrofit.
Also, don't come home a drinking with love.
Family Rose is a great album.
That's the one she did with Jack White.
There's a song on that called Portland, Oregon. But this is not a
Loretta Lynn podcast
and just fanning Travis's ego podcast.
Welcome to Cinema Chop Shop. We are back and we're in the proper studio tonight after our adventure with Wanted Man, the watch party.
That was fun, you guys. I wish I could have been there for it, but I did sync up and watch the movie with your guys's commentary. And I felt like I was in the room. I kept trying to interject.
I unfortunately listened to it a second time with my wife, Allie. She watched it. And we did the experience like not 2 days after we did it. So
nice.
I got my fill of that fucking movie.
I bet you did.
Yeah. Like 4 times you saw it?
Two total. Right. It felt like four. But we're not talking about that today. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Blind Spots.
Wait, you haven't seen that?
It's something we've been kind of talking about for a while, and that is films that are egregiously absent from our filmographies. And so we all selected two films that we have not seen that we feel that we probably should have seen by now, committed, buckled down, and watched those films. And we're going to talk about those tonight.
And I think it's a really kind of panel-specific subject, because just because I haven't seen this movie doesn't mean that any of you haven't seen it or anybody listening hasn't seen it, but it's our personal blind spots. I had a really hard time with this one.
I guess I should go around the panel and introduce everybody in case you didn't pick up on that. We've got Travisito.
Hello.
We've got Joey Poo.
Here I am.
And we got Todd.
Howdy.
And I'm your host, Sean. Without further ado, we're going to jump right in and talk about each other's blind spots. Mm-hmm. And Todd, let's get you to go first.
All righty. One of my big blind spots is from one of the all-time great directors who's most of his movies I've seen, although I realize not a lot of his early ones, but in any case, his major ones, but one that slipped my focus for whatever reason was 2001 A Space Odyssey from 1968.
You're about Stanley Kubrick?
Yeah.
Mr. Kubrick?
Yeah. My reasoning behind this, I don't really have a good reason other than I knew that it was kind of a slow burn thinker.
It is.
And whenever it would pop into my head to watch, I just wouldn't be in the mood for it. And then it wouldn't pop into my head when I was in the mood for that sort of movie. That's the best explanation I have.
And how long is it? I know it's unwieldy, and it seems very long, but how long actually is it?
It actually didn't seem that long when I watched it. I thought it was like 3 hours. It was like 2:20.
Yeah, 2:20 sounds about right.
And if you recall, there's the beginning and the intermission both have really long kind of orchestra parts with black screen that you could theoretically kind of fast forward through. So
or
if you cut that out, it's like
in the yard.
Yeah, exactly. So if you take those out, it's probably more like 2:05, something like that. So it really wasn't as bad as what I was expecting. I didn't feel like I was being that I was having to force myself to kind of get through it, even though it did have a deliberate pace. It infamously has very little dialogue, especially the final act of the film, which is amazing. And I think that's why it didn't bother me that it didn't have any dialogue, because it was just too riveting what was happening on the screen. My best reason for why I never watched it is just I wasn't in for that sort of movie when I thought of it, and then I wouldn't think of it when I was.
So now you've seen it.
Yep.
You get to see all of those cultural touchstones, all those memes, all those things, all of those well-known elements in context. What's your takeaway?
Well, so to be honest with you, I was aware of some of them, of course, the whole thing with Hal, which I actually found myself kind of moved when he was like begging for his life, even though he had just murdered the whole crew. But nevertheless, I kind of felt something for Hal as he was, you know, begging to be spared.
Sorry to interrupt, but that seems especially prescient now, given our current sort of like fixation with
AI. I was just going to say that Stanley Kubrick predicted 9/11.
Yep.
I was going to ask Todd, what's your take on AI?
Yeah. Well, and that was one of the interesting things about the movie is in some ways, Hal might have been the most emotive character by the end. Because there was a lot of the famous Kubrick iciness throughout the movie with a lot of the characters. The opening sequence, of course, I was aware of the bone going into the air and turning into the spaceship.
It's been parodied so many times in so many films, or homaged. Yep.
And it was a little campy looking back, the men in like the hominid suits, I guess, yeah. And still enjoyable. And then when the monolith comes up, I didn't know all the stuff about the monolith. That was cool stuff, creepy stuff. The giant fetus at the end. Of course, I've seen, like, Rick and Morty has a thing with that kind of plays off of that. And I had no idea that was. I don't think I was really aware of that ending.
So it seems like to me that your first time experience with this movie was a positive one.
Yeah, yeah, and pretty pure. I mean, again, I noted some of the cultural touchstones, but a lot of it, like I said, the ending, I did not know what was going to happen. I was very much riveted by what was happening, even though there wasn't the dialogue, like I said, particularly at the end. That whole sequence with him, after he disconnects Hal and then speeds towards the monolith, all those
trippy vibes, baby.
Yeah, man. Shagadelic, baby. And then the scene he's suddenly in this weird room where he sees himself, and then he turns into that older version of himself, and then he turns into the other version of himself, and now he's a fetus once he reaches out for that monolith.
If you could describe the message of the movie in one word, it would be like continuum.
Yeah. Well, that was one thing that I thought was interesting about the movie is all this debate about, is it supposed to be like a cynical thing, like the baby's on its way to destroy Earth? Because apparently something that got... that Kubrick decided to downplay in the movie is that there were supposed to be these nuclear weapon satellites orbiting Earth, and the fetus, some people speculated, might have been going to like set them off.
Wow.
But apparently something like that happened in the novel, I think. There was something about... And Kubrick apparently decided to downplay that element because just a few weeks or a few months before the film came out, Russia or the Soviet Union and the U.S. made an agreement that they wouldn't put nuclear weapons in outer space, and he didn't want it to seem like it was behind the times or that it was speaking on something that was too topical or that kind of thing.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's been years since I saw it, but I remember thinking at the time that the fetus was more symbolic of like the next sort of rebirth, or the next,
the next,
because
rebirth,
it's all about like when the monolith shows up, it's like the next step.
And that's I thought of that as well, and that's definitely one of the interpretations. The people that have the more positive spin on it, but then a lot of people I was reading that had the more negative spin, some people say, well, they're reading too much into what he had to say in the previous film, which was Dr. Strangelove. Which was much more negative about humanity. So they were looking for... So the people that read it that way, I think, are looking at a continuum of Kubrick's themes.
I was just going to say this. I'm glad you liked it. This is probably the first film that I saw. You know, I was a movie fan since I was a kid, but this was probably the first movie that I watched that was kind of like set me on this road to being either a cinephile or a pretentious prick, depending on how you read it. But it was
guilty.
Like,
both can be true.
Both are true with me. Yeah. But this was kind of the first one, and I rented it because I thought that it was going to be like a standard, science fiction flick or whatever. Right. And I was a fan, and it is it very much is a science fiction flick, but it pushes it in a much more literary, cinematic, philosophical kind of way.
And one thing that surprised me about the movie is apparently it was a blockbuster. It made $150 million in 1968 money. So whatever
budget,
that projects to of $10.5 million.
Wow.
So that
good
just
return.
Yeah. And it doesn't seem like the kind of movie that would have ended up being a blockbuster, but maybe that just speaks more to the times, and it certainly wouldn't have been a blockbuster today, that type of movie.
Oh no, this would be way too heady.
Yeah. So
I don't know. I mean, you've got your Denis Villeneuve, you've got your Luc Bessons. They're doing a little bit more heady sci-fi. You got your
Arrival. Arrival.
Yeah, was Arrival a blockbuster though?
No, it wasn't a blockbuster.
I love that. I mean, I do. Yeah. Right. I do love that movie.
Sorry, Amy Adams.
Yeah.
Yep. But
love you, Amy.
Yeah, though I'm glad. I mean, I was almost glad that I hadn't seen it before because I was really able to kind of sink into the experience and enjoy it.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah,
good deal. So this podcast is doing good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right,
we're doing good deeds.
So I can check that off my box there and not be embarrassed anymore.
Lovely. Well, then let's pop over to JoJo.
Well, I chose for this one. First, I want to say there was a honorable mention one that I'm going to watch, and Todd actually tried to get me to watch The Dark Knight for this one. I have not yet watched it, and I will be watching it.
Either of the other two Nolan Batman films?
No.
So you've not seen any of the Christopher Nolan Batman movies?
No.
All right.
There's a story about why.
You don't necessarily.
I don't like Batman.
I don't think that
Christian Bale.
No, I was maybe
ran into you in the grocery store.
He was the caterer on the set that he yelled at.
Yeah.
I was maybe 16 when the first dark Batman came out. I guess the Michael Keaton one or whatever, and it came out the same month as Star Trek V. Mm-hmm. And this is a point in my life when I had
1989. Batman,
yeah,
Tim Burton Batman,
and so I just started reading movie reviews and again the cinephile journey, and I read the state newspaper in Columbia ran a double review of Batman and Star Trek V, and the premise of it basically was that here's Batman coming to blow the doors off of science fiction fantasy type stuff, whereas Star Trek V still living
deeply
in the past like
a
dinosaur, and immediately I was like, fuck Batman.
Ellie was the only subscriber to Variety magazine in Pillion, South Carolina,
and that's why to this day I have a hateful grudge against Batman. But
did you go to
like Christopher Nolan, and I will watch Dark Knight at some point. I watched what should I do first? I'm gonna do Butch Cassidy and the Sundance
Kid.
This is one
like the bicycle scene.
Yeah. I love the whole movie. Yeah. But yeah, the bicycle
raindrops
scene especially.
Keep falling on
that
my head.
This movie might actually be my first big cinema movie, and I didn't even know it because it would come on AMC all the time in the mid-ish 90s, and so I just kind of watched it then, and I watched it a bunch when I was probably 16, 17.
I don't really have a reason for why this one fell through the cracks. It just did.
Yeah.
I like the Western genre, but I'm kind of picky about it. I don't really care for the Golden Age of Hollywood Westerns. I like the grittier
one of the
ones.
First revisionist.
Yes,
Westerns.
You like the revisionist type.
Yeah, and this one, for whatever reason, just fell through the cracks. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, they're outlaws. They're played here as roguishly charming outlaws. You got Paul Newman, of course, as Butch Cassidy. Robert Redford as Sundance Kid, his kind of quiet, quick draw.
So they went with an ugly cast.
Sidekick. Yeah, it's very, very hard on the eyes. Catherine Ross as Etta, too.
If they would have switched the names, the title would not have been nearly as appealing. Butch Kid and
Sundance Cassidy.
Sundance Cassidy.
doesn't roll off the tongue. Also starring, and I use that term loosely, Sam Elliott.
As card player
number two,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very memorable role. I didn't realize he was in the film until I happened to see him in the credits. But this is a very, very loose take on the real life Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. It says it's based on a true story, but it's a more or less purely mythological take on their life. And my take on it is this. While it kind of peddles in anti-hero worship, some of the grittier Westerns of the time, the spaghetti Westerns would have been before this,
mm-hmm.
The Man with No Name, Fistful of Dollars, The Man with No Name is the character, but the movie I'm thinking of
the
is
Sergio Leone trilogy.
Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and those, yeah. Mm-hmm. This one kind of pays homage to that, but to me, this feels like Hollywood's take on the anti-hero Western. Because it, you wouldn't have seen in the 50s and 60s, you wouldn't have seen a film centered on, two polyamorous outlaws who make their living robbing trains. But despite the fact that they're kind of anti-heroes, it very much does have that Hollywood Western mythology, and it's a very lighthearted, kind of breezy picture. So it's kind of stuck between those two poles, I think. This week, and this is purely a coincidence, I started reading Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. It just happened to come off of my library hold at the same time as this, as I was watching for this podcast.
Do you call your ears your library holes?
My library hold. Oh, okay. I had it on hold from the library, and it finally came in. And whereas Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid very much revels in and pays homage to Hollywood Western mythology, Blood Meridian, the novel, McCarthy's novel, is a deeply cynical, ultra-violent attempt to just destroy all of that Western mythology. So those two things just happened upon me at the same time by pure chance.
Well, after you follow that up with another one that you thought about watching, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is probably one of my favorite movies, period, but certainly the more cynical take on the Western, and going so far, Stephen, it's not even in the, you know, the typical, you know, desert type setting. It's in a snowy, wet, you know, terrible,
like Pacific Northwest kind of thing, right? Yeah,
you're turning me on.
All the prostitutes are fat and ugly, and you know, that kind of thing.
That actually made the short list of films I would watch for this podcast.
But
it's a great movie.
So positive experience. We covered this movie on a previous episode. I think we were talking about the new wave of Westerns.
Yeah, we did a whole revisionist Westerns episode. Yeah.
Well, this is also movie. Considered one of the great screenplays by William Goldman, the great very quippy dialogue.
And so another interesting tidbit that I think that we pointed out on that episode is that originally Paul Newman and Robert Redford were cast inversely. Sundance was Butch.
That would have been a much worse movie, because Robert Redford is not the quippy type of guy. Like, he was in the role he should have been in. So they changed.
Well,
that.
One last thing I want to add. And I did, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen this 60-year-old movie, but the ending is. I started to say ambiguous. Sad? So at the very end of the movie, you can stop listening if you haven't seen it. You're going to watch it. Basically, they're holed up. They're ambushed by. They finally get to Bolivia.
Yeah.
And the fucking army, the Bolivian army, shows up, and they don't know that the army's there. They think they're just in a shootout with a couple of guys. They're already wounded, and they go rush out to charge. Mm-hmm. And the film fades to black. Obviously, they're supposed to die. If anybody out there in listener land knows of fan fiction that follows them to Australia, where they're dreaming about going, please tell me.
I really do think there is
Don't tell me there's a motherfucking sequel.
I don't think it's a sequel. I think it's like maybe a comic book or something like that that imagines that they escape.
Somebody track that down for me
please,
and alert
listeners,
me of it.
Email us at cinemachopshop@gmail.com.
Travis,
it's my turn.
It's your turn.
Jesus Christ, man. I wanted to go first, and then you're like, hey, Todd, hey, Joey, come on. All right, so my first one is an overlooked film. It's an overlooked film called Defending Your Life from 1991. It was directed, written, and starring Albert Brooks. All right, first, I'm going to give you the synopsis. Daniel Miller isn't having a good week. For starters, he died after getting hit by a bus. Then he discovers that in the afterlife, he must defend his actions on Earth in order to ascend to a higher plane of existence. While awaiting judgment, he falls in love with Julia, whose near-perfect life on Earth seemingly makes her a shoo-in for ascension. However, Daniel's actions in his lifetime might not be enough for him to move on. So it's starring Albert Brooks as Daniel Miller, Meryl Streep as Julia, Rip Torn as Bob Diamond, Daniel's attorney, Lee Grant, who you'd know from Shampoo, as Lena Foster, the prosecutor, Buck Henry.
Yay, Buck!
Buck Henry as Dick Stanley, Daniel's substitute attorney. Now, if you don't know who Buck Henry is, he was in The Graduate, he was in What's Up, Doc, Catch-22, Shortcuts. He co-created Get Smart with Mel Brooks.
Yep.
He was a member of, or is a member of SNL's Five Timers Club, having hosted 10 times between 1976 and 1980. He hosted 10 times in 4 years.
He was kind of a contributor slash
He was a writer for SNL, yeah. Yes.
He wasn't a full-time cast member, but he was always around.
Yeah, and then also we have a cameo from Shirley MacLaine as a holographic host of the Pastimes Pavilion, a reference to her publicly known belief in reincarnation. To understand this movie, you have to understand who Albert Brooks was. He was born Albert Lawrence Einstein. His name at birth was Albert Einstein. In July of 1947, he was born into a Jewish show business family in Beverly Hills, California. His grandparents emigrated from Austria and Russia. His mother was an actress, and his father, Harry Einstein, was a radio personality and comedian who performed on Eddie Cantor's radio program and was known as the Parkia Carcass.
What?
P-A-R-K-Y-A-K-A-R-K-U-S. Parkia Carcass.
All right.
You guys have defined that for
basically, like, sit your body down, I guess. Parkia Carcass. all of his four brothers are in the business as well. He grew up among show business families
from,
in Southern California, attending Beverly Hills High School with Richard Dreyfuss and Rob Reiner.
Wow.
So if that gives you like a feel for his comedic sensibilities.
Yeah.
By age 19, he had changed his professional name to Albert Brooks, joking that, quote, the real Albert Einstein changed his name to sound more intelligent. In the late 60s and 70s, he was regularly performing stand-up, recording two comedy albums, and working as a comedy writer for television. In 1975, Brooks directed six short films for the first season of SNL. In 1976, he appeared in his first mainstream film role in Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Scorsese allowed Brooks to improvise most of his dialogue. Through the 80s and 90s, he co-wrote, directed, and starred in a series of well-received comedies, playing variants of his standard neurotic and self-obsessed character. He did Modern Romance, Lost in America, which I really want to see.
I've seen that one in I've seen Modern Romance, Lost in America. And didn't he do Broadcast News? Was that him?
Well, he was on Broadcast News.
Okay, he didn't direct it, though. Okay.
No. He was in Broadcast News.
Gotcha.
Mother and the Muse, along with Defending Your Life. Also, he played or did the voice of Hank Scorpio on The Simpsons in the episode You Only Move Twice. Also, if you're going for a visual reference on this audio medium, he looks just like our good friend Brian.
Yes, he does.
So the film was well received. It's got a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. If that doesn't sell it for you, Sean, in 2020... it was inducted into the Criterion Collection.
Well, that's great. It's an outlying kind of movie for the episode, but I understand that you have seen pretty much everything.
I've seen all the movies.
I mean, you've done your movie marathon for, what, 6 years now?
About 17 years.
Yeah, so...
That's if you do 365 a year, you're going to see most of them. Yeah.
So Travis is digging for obscure films at this point.
I'm blind spotting.
Yeah. Happens once a month. All right. I'm going to jump in with mine. My first film is from the year 2000.
In the year 2000.
It's Castaway.
Yes.
I did not see Castaway.
I'm dying to know if you loved or hated this movie.
Yeah, I was, I steered clear of this film because...
The sequel to You've Got Mail?
Yeah, totally. I steered clear of this movie because at the time I was deeply entrenched. You're talking about being the elitist snob film person. I was not watching this big blockbuster film. I just didn't want to see it. And I never really had anything against Tom Hanks. I loved some of Tom Hanks' lesser films as a kid. The Burbs and Dragnet. You know, that kind of... I like his stuff that's...
Bachelor Party?
Yeah.
He has a lot of movies that are way overrated, though. Like,
yeah. And so, so I steered clear of it for those reasons. So now I've watched it. Directed by Robert Zemeckis. Mm-hmm. Tom Hanks plays Chuck Noland, a higher up in FedEx. And, you know, out of all the FedEx commercials I've ever seen, this is the best one.
Yes.
I mean, this movie was clearly funded by FedEx.
Lot of product placement.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Isn't there a scene at the end where he delivers the packages that he kept
the whole time? Yeah. the one package, and it's the girl that you're like, oh, does he or doesn't he? I'm convinced that UPS shot down that plane.
Mm-hmm. And when he delivered the package, he said, you've got mail.
It also stars Helen Hunt playing Kelly Frears.
All right, I'm going to be on board with this because I've railed on Helen Hunt on this podcast.
Yep. The film, of course, starts out with him in Russia. He's trying to train these lazy Russians how to get the packages out on time. And he comes back home. Helen Hunt berates him because she's a ironclad bitch.
She's a real, what's the word?
See you next Tuesday.
Yeah.
The thing that's on your leg. Like there's a ball and chain. She's a real ball and chain.
There you go. Good. You got there, buddy.
You got it. Yeah.
She doesn't want him to go away again. And he's like, I got to go to this one other thing. We got to go to Malaysia. And they exchange Christmas gifts in the car at the airport. He goes, it has the plane has some sort of malfunction, a really cool crash sequence.
For the time, I thought
beautifully
it was well done.
And he's the sole survivor. He ends up in the life raft, and he washes ashore at his island. And that, of course, occupies the second act of the film, where he learns how to survive. And
the majority of the film.
It's really not, though, actually, because the opening of the film is about 20, 25 minutes, and then the final part of the film is a good 30 minutes. So it's really just the meat of the middle.
Okay.
It's the burger. As the meat in the hamburger.
Didn't that that volleyball get an Oscar nod for supporting actor?
I sure hope.
Wilson should have. Wilson.
He survives. He devises a raft that gets him back into the shipping lanes, where he's rescued and he gets integrated back into society.
Helen, and Wilson, he loses Wilson.
He loses,
in a
he
harrowing
loses
scene.
Wilson. Yes,
sorry.
Helen has married Christopher Noth from Sex and the City,
Mr. Big,
and they've had kids, and he reconnects with her. And
so, how long was he on?
Four years. He becomes
very
adept at surviving after it is a pretty rough start.
He also grows a beard almost as long as Sean's.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So some notes I took in the film, I can't imagine being stranded and Helen Hunt is the only picture you have to look at.
Oh, gosh.
Wait, let me
look. Note number two.
I don't have
really like his beard. Aspiring.
I think I'm going to echo what Todd was about to say. I don't really have strong opinions
about
Helen Hunt.
What is the deal?
She's very plain.
Oh, she's
People
just awful.
Present her as some sort of like sexy person, but she's not.
She's never been sexy.
No,
and
she's at the very best astringent and angular.
She was cute and Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Wasn't she in that with Sarah Jessica Parker?
That was her peak. She peaked in high school.
Yeah. Is it just me, or was the starting the fire scene a bit like masturbation? Mm-hmm. Like, he really got there. Apparently, when you are on an island by yourself, you pass out a lot.
Oh, he was malnourished.
Yeah. Well, there was a whole thing with the tooth.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, that was pretty excruciating.
Yeah,
That was pretty rough. And then, of course, there was the tree that looks like a person that has the noose on it. I was like, that's a little on the nose. And then later, there's a payoff.
Mm-hmm.
So did you like it?
I thought it was fine.
I like that movie a lot.
I like
I
this movie
admit
a lot
that it's
too.
A,
yeah.
It's
a
blockbuster.
For
it's
survival.
It's sentimental, but it's a blockbuster type thing. And that's probably one of my favorite Tom Hanks movies.
It's a Tom Hanks vehicle, and he drove that.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah. He definitely carried the film.
You might say that he was the captain. Now,
yes.
To me, that was the film. If you were going to give him a Best Actor Oscar, that's the more memorable role than say. I mean, I'm not a big Forrest Gump guy, and certainly Philadelphia is very forgettable.
Yeah, he was nominated. I was surprised that Robert Zemeckis was the director. I felt that it probably would have been better suited for like a Ron Howard.
It is interesting because Zemeckis is known for visuals.
Yeah.
And this movie is, I mean, it's got good scenes. It's got good setting, but it's not a visual movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't play to his wheelhouse. And that's why I was like, oh, Zemeckis did this. Wow. I totally thought like a Ron Howard would be the one to
like
do it.
Yeah, it seems like a Ron Howard movie.
Yes, there's a lot of sappiness. I will give
Or a Rob Reiner.
Rob Reiner would do it well, too. I give the movie a lot of credit for the reuniting scene with Tom Hanks and Helen Hunt.
They resisted the obvious. So
then you can feel the emotions and the connection between the two. She's torn because she's got a family now and things have changed. But in her body language, I'll give her credit. In her body language, there was this lean forward that she was doing that was like, yep, she really wants to be with him. And I was like, okay, that's cool.
When they when the extra reunited scene, right?
Yeah.
And then she just ends up going back to her family now, right?
Yeah, totally. Yep.
And he has to go deal with that.
Yeah.
I have a memory of watching this movie for the first time on DVD at my friend DJ's house.
DJ?
This is two podcasts in a row where I've mentioned my friend Tony from Spain, and he was with us. And we were all just openly weeping at the end of the movie. I
wasn't that moved by it, but I thought it was fine. I would give it a solid 3 out of 5 stars, maybe.
I think we had a case of Red Dog that night.
Tony's from Spain. They have weird customs there. They actually collect each other's tears in shot glasses.
And they shoot it at the end of the movie. Yes. Nice. All right, so that's it. That's the first half of our blind spots. You haven't seen that episode. So we're going to take a break and go pee in the yard and refill these beers, but not before we say,
let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby
and get ourselves some blank space, baby, and I'll write your name.
Okay.
Yum, yum. It's time for a tasty and refreshing snack. We promise to satisfy your hunger, your thirst, your sweet tooth. So visit our refreshment center now. Let's go.
And we're back, and we all took a pee in the yard, and we're opening new beers. Travis, you said you had a beer check-in.
I do have a beer check-in. The first one is going to be the 420 G13 from Sweetwater, because they got the government weed.
They do. I've been drinking Dos Equis because of the two X's are the blind spots in our filmography. Mm-hmm. That's as close as I could get on a on theme beer. Joey, you brought a cool one.
Yeah, it's the Grand Strand Brewing, and it's, what's it called? Sandy Cheeks.
Sandy Cheeks. Yeah. So Grand Strand Brewing, it's a localish brewery. They're in Myrtle Beach. They opened up about 2 years ago.
If that.
Yeah, I think about 2 years ago. And,
this one's a West Coast style IPA, and it's pretty good. As
so far, so good.
It's kind of like a little behind the times, I think, in style, but their hazy IPA is really nice. Yeah.
They, they're much better than other alternative breweries in Myrtle Beach.
Yes. And Todd, you've got
Edmund's Oast from Charleston, South Carolina brewery, and it is the Bound by Time IPA.
Bound by Time is good.
It is good.
Solid beer.
Very good. Yep.
All right, we're going to roll right into the second half, and we'll keep the same
rotation
going. So Todd, you're up next with your next film.
Don't fuck with the cipher. I think this one actually got more gasps of shock from our crew here than did my first film, which is Arnold Schwarzenegger's great action film Predator from the
80s. How is it that you've not seen the original Predator?
This one is shocking. Yeah,
well, so I think I have a better explanation for this than 2001. I think it just I just sort of missed it during the VHS era, and
I'm
then
sorry. This movie did not come out in 2001.
Right.
See, I don't understand the premise of what you just said. You just sort of missed it in the VHS era, because when you walked into your small town VHS rental shop, South Carolina. Yeah. There would have been 5 or 6 copies of Predator sitting there that you had to walk past.
But what I mean when
to get
in
I spit
nickels.
On your grave or something.
But here's the thing: when it initially came out, I wouldn't have been old. I would have been going to the VHS store with my parents.
So you're
who
too
would
young
not
at
have
the time.
So I was too young.
Okay. They
and then
let
when
you
I got
pick
older,
the movie.
Yeah. And then when I got older, I think I got too snobby. I just assumed that it was like a mindless Schwarzenegger action flick.
Now,
I think that's what happened.
Did you watch any of the subsequent films?
No.
You've never seen a Predator film?
I was like, well, I've never seen Predator.
Well,
so
it's all downhill from here, except for Prey.
Prey is great.
Prey is good.
So, yeah, so I think I got snobby about, you know, what I would, you know, and just didn't watch it after that. But then, you know, I realized as years passed, it's like, oh, this seems to be more highly regarded than I expected it might be. And so when I watched it, I enjoyed the hell out of it.
So your snobometer went down a little bit.
It did.
And you allowed yourself.
It did.
And actually, in this,
my snobometer had gone down enough to allow for it years ago, but I just didn't get around to it. To me, this movie though is like a sci-fi update of the classic film, The Most Dangerous Game. If you've ever seen that,
Of course.
You know, this guy goes to a rich guy's island, and the rich guy hunts him.
Yeah,
and
based on the book, and also there's been many film.
Many iterations of that, right. And this is kind of the premise of this movie. This alien lands. They don't really give us any background about this alien, except it seems like we learned that he just goes to Earth every 20 years or so and hunts people for sport. He's just, you know, finds
their hunters.
That is the beauty of that first film, is because
there's so much
you don't have to know anything other than he's out to kill.
Exactly.
That's it. That's all you need.
Honestly, I kind of like digging into the mythology and the ecology of the
it gave them great fodder for the sequels and stuff, which was cool.
Can we talk about the crossovers?
Alien
versus Predator.
I like them. Save it.
Me too.
Save it.
One thing though that I thought was cool about the movie is that, you know, my snobbishness about it, I think the filmmakers were aware of this because they kind of played up to that initially, where it seemed like it was just going to be one of these exploding huts, action one line. You know, in the first, you know, 15 minutes or so, Arnold's getting off one liner after another. Kind of seems like one of those dumb action flicks. But then once the twist happens and we find out all's not what we thought that it was, it gets much more serious tone.
And the movie really condenses in on itself very quickly. The cast, I think, buffets what you were just saying about, you know, you've got Carl Weathers, rest in peace. You've got Jesse Ventura.
Bill Duke was fantastic in this.
Does Jesse the Body get he delivers the, I ain't got time to bleed.
I ain't got time to bleed. That was him. Yep.
Now you tell me what you're going to do if you're bleeding out in the middle of Panama and the Predator's standing over you. You tell me what's going to happen.
That's actually a pretty spot on
impersonation.
Thank
you, Jesse Ventura, for that audio clip. We appreciate it.
That's actually
still
pretty
spot on. Still
can't
believe we got you.
Yeah, but anyway, so I liked that the movie showed a little bit of self-awareness at the beginning, and then the middle, I mean, it's very smart, the way that it plays out in the middle of the movie, the way that... So, you know, some of the stuff with the some of the graphics and stuff were a little bit dated, but that's okay for the most part. Though I think it works pretty well
for the time.
Yeah,
it was amazing special effects,
especially the design of the Predator itself. Yeah. Insectoid mouth.
Yeah,
I mean,
and then the infrared vision that it had that had not really been done before.
Yep. And then the fact too, it was a little creepy touch that it would mimic people. And then when it finally lost Arnold Schwarzenegger, it did that. You know, it was like, all right, I'm gonna take you down with me thing. And then it did the laugh of his friend to signal the fact that he was about to blow shit up. I thought that was a nice little
question. Is the line "Get to the chopper" from this?
Yes,
or from
"Get
Commando"?
To the chopper. I thought of you when that happened.
He
says it
to me.
He said, "Yeah," because you've said it a couple times when I've done the podcast. But
I say it a lot.
Well, I think particularly when I was talking about Kindergarten Cop in one episode, you mentioned it. But get to the chopper. That's in there. I was very impressed with it. Great performances. Like I said, Bill Duke was really good as one of the soldiers who starts to kind of lose it a little bit. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a really smart film, actually, for, you know.
I think we might have to do a Aliens versus Predator franchise overview.
Oh, yeah.
I'm down with that.
I think that'd be fun.
I'm a fan. I mean, the Alien versus Predator movies, they are what they are.
Yeah. I think they're low stakes.
But, exactly. Yeah. But they're pretty damn good.
It's not like Star Wars versus Star Trek.
That's another episode. But, I mean, I think that Todd is standing upon the precipice of an undiscovered country here because there's a rich wellspring of sequels and crossovers in this franchise that you can explore. Yeah. And Alien is one of your favorite films, right?
The first one, yeah. I like it a lot.
So there's a whole crossover here, too. Mm-hmm.
All right. So we're in exciting times here in Todd's life. Mm-hmm. All right, Joey, what you got, man?
This next one is perhaps the most egregious oversight in my film watching acumen. And this one is doubly egregious for me because, A, it's a very iconic film, but also it's kind of in my own personal wheelhouse. Like, I'm a huge fan of film noir, mid-century film noir, and this isn't exactly a noir, but it's noir adjacent. It's Casablanca, in case you haven't figured that out yet.
Nobody figured that out.
Anyway, you'd say it's noir adjacent.
Yeah, I would agree.
You got Humphrey Bogart basically doing his Sam Spade shtick.
Yeah, totally.
It's a dark sort of film. And often when I watch movies like this one that have accrued all of this cultural and critical cachet, I am somewhat...
skeptical?
I'm let down.
Okay.
A little bit, because... even if they're not bad, they can't live up to the hype. This one, 100% lived up to the hype. So
it's a badass movie.
Casablanca, as I'm sure everyone listening knows, is set in Casablanca, which was in then French-occupied
Morocco.
Came out in 1942, set very much in World War II. Mm-hmm. Rick's Café Américain, where all of the rich elite from Europe have descended upon North Africa in an attempt to get the fuck out of Europe at this time. The big door prize is a ticket to Lisbon, from which you can depart to North America. The film takes place there amidst that whole drama. Rick, the owner of the bar, played, as I said, by Humphrey Bogart, is moving along just fine. He's trying to stay neutral, stay out of the war, but of all the gin joints.
Yep. In all the world.
In all the towns, in all the world. Ilsa, his former love, has to walk into this one. She's now married to a Czech dissenter who has escaped. He's a wealthy Czech dissenter who has escaped from... concentration camp, and therein lies the plot of the film. I don't know what
played
I can say.
Played
by Ingrid Bergman, yeah. This one is also is directed by the very prolific Michael Curtis, a couple of things that I found interesting here. He did, he made a lot of like swashbuckler films, like Adventures of Robin Hood, but he also did Angels with Dirty Faces.
Nice.
He did White Christmas, which is the first movie that I ever discussed on this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Whoa.
In Travis's living room long, long ago.
That was a while ago.
Good
and
times.
He also did a film called Mission to Moscow, which was essentially a propaganda film.
Are you talking about Police Academy 3, Mission to Moscow?
I am not. I am not. But it was commissioned by FDR. And he also is responsible for the current laws that we have about animal cruelty on set after 25 horses died during the filming of his film, Charge of the Light Brigade.
So he's not responsible for it. Like, he didn't, like, promote that legislation. The legislation is because of him.
His epic fuck-up paved the way for it. But despite that, this is a great, great, great film. I don't know what I'm going to say about it other than that. I mean, we're sitting underneath a poster of it.
Yep.
And,
right now.
And the title of another great movie comes from this film. Does anybody know?
We'll Always Have Paris.
No?
No, that's a Star Trek The Next Generation episode.
God damn it, Joey.
Nerd.
Anybody.
What now?
There's a title of a famous 1990s film that we all love that comes from a quote in this film.
Oh, I don't know.
The Usual Suspects.
Gotcha.
Yes, at the very end. The French officer, played by Claude Rains, after Rick is killed the German officer, in order to protect his love, he tells him to round up the usual suspects.
God, this movie is so stocked with good actors too. You got Peter Lorre in it. It's so good.
And
it's
I think it's a great film.
This is a great film. I wouldn't say that it's the best film of all time, but I do think that it is perhaps the pinnacle of
Bogart.
I know I was a little bit in my cups last night when I texted Sean and said, I couldn't tell if you were being serious or funny.
Dude,
Casablanca is the pinnacle of Western culture. Did I say that? Is that what it said?
That's civilization. What you said.
Oh, it's the Western civilization. Okay.
And the downfall is tater tots.
Yeah, yes, it is. That's another podcast. But I wasn't far off. I wouldn't say it's the best film of all time, but I had to put a movie in a time capsule to represent the golden era of Hollywood, you know, that whole mid-century thing, this would be it. Name a better one.
Yeah, it's got...
I mean, have you seen The Maltese Falcon?
It's pretty fucking good.
It's also very good.
But this The African Queen?
Yeah, that's another one that's great. But Casablanca has so many iconic moments in the film, I think, that are quote-worthy,
meme-worthy. Sam.
And
he never actually says
He never actually says it. Yeah, It's a good movie, and it definitely has its flag in the ground in terms of those kind of
things. One thing he does say, here's looking at you, kid.
Another thing that amazed me about this is that, like, this is a movie very much about World War II, which was made pretty much in real time.
Yeah.
It was made in 1942, and you can kind of see it. Maybe I'm getting a little up my own ass here. But you can kind of see this film as like a critique of America's neutrality.
Yeah.
Because Rick himself is very much into staying neutral.
Right.
Like he, you know, he doesn't want any trouble in his bar, no politics in his bar. But then over the course of the film, he's forced to choose.
Yeah.
And he chooses, you know.
Much like the United States had to choose whether or not to be involved.
Yes. And so that's doubly interesting because there's a previous film in Michael Curtis's filmography, which was kind of thought of at the time as a scathing critique of America's neutrality. I think he kind of watered it down and made it, you know, amenable here. But just, I mean, just a great movie. Instantly jumped near the top of my best of all time. I love it.
Good deal. Travis, do I even dare ask what big blockbuster movie that you haven't seen, I want to
do another beer check-in.
Go ahead.
This is Waves on Waves by Westbrook.
Westbrook, yeah.
Westbrook Brewing, and it's a double dry hopped, double IPA. And I think it's fine. It's a little bit malty. Your thoughts?
It's a little funky, a little bit too malty. It's overdone.
Overdone. You know, every time I bring a beer.
It's not your fault. It's
Sean
not,
got something to say about it.
I'm not slamming you. You didn't brew it. Ed Westbrook did.
My movie.
Is that a shot across the bow towards the gentleman you just named?
No, I like Westbrook. Westbrook's fine.
We're not going to get into that war.
Okay.
If Mr. Westbrook decides to sponsor us, I especially like the white tie.
Yeah, white tie's good. I like the two claw.
Two Claw's good. Mexican cake's good.
I'm going to do a movie that I've never seen before, and this is a blind spot for me. Like, legit, because it's a PTA film. Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah. Great movie.
That does seem like a pretty shocking oversight for you.
Every other one of his movies, never seen this. Mm.
This is the first one that we've discussed thus far, I believe, that I have not seen either. So.
Well, you didn't see Defending Your Life.
Yeah, you're right, but I never heard of it either, so I don't.
All right, so Punch Drunk Love came out in 2002, directed and written by Paul Thomas Anderson. So the synopsis, although susceptible to violent outbursts, bathroom supply business owner Barry Egan is a timid and shy man by disposition, leading a lonely, uneventful life, partly due to the constant berating he suffers from his seven sisters. He's got seven sisters. However, several events transpire that shake up Egan's mundane existence. For example, in his loneliness, he calls a phone sex line. The next morning, the phone sex girl calls him back and starts to extort him for money. And we're talking 2002.
I was going to say, I feel like we should explain to the youngins out here what a phone sex light is.
Yeah, so there used to be this thing called 1-900 numbers where you could call and it was like $2 a minute. And it
would totally show up on your mom and dad's phone bill, by the way.
And their credit card experience.
I'm speaking from my cousin's experience.
Okay, there we go. Yeah. Nice.
They start to extort him, and he's like, no, I'm not going to give you money. I don't have money. You can't have that. I sell toilet paper. Philip Seymour Hoffman, his character, gets the boys on the mission, and it's four blonde brothers who come and start like attacking him. During this, he accidentally falls in love with his sister's coworker, and her name is Lena. But the romance is threatened when Egan falls victim to this extortion scheme. So it's starring Adam Sandler as Barry Egan, an unmarried entrepreneur, and he has social anxiety. Emily Watson, who I think is very underrated. She's a English actress. She plays Lena, and she's Barry's love interest and Elizabeth's friend and coworker. We got Philip Seymour Hoffman, rest in peace, as Dean Trumbull, the owner of the mattress store, which is a front for this sex line blackmail extortion scheme. We've got Marilyn Rajkub as Elizabeth Egan, who is his sister, who's also, gosh, she was in 24. She's in Always Sunny in Philadelphia. She's the snail. In Always Sunny in Philadelphia, she's the cousin who's always like snotty. You would recognize her if you saw her. We got Luis Guzman, a regular of PTA films.
Love it.
As Lance, Barry's coworker. And then Robert Smigel. Robert Smigel as Walter, a dentist, and Barry's brother-in-law, who he confides in after an angry outburst.
Robert Smigel, creator of the Ambiguously Gay duo.
And the angry dog, what's his name?
Oh, Triumph the Insult Comedy Dog.
He's a dentist and Barry's brother-in-law, who Barry confides in. He's like, hey, listen, I heard you're a doctor. I need some help. Sometimes I don't like myself. And he's like, Barry, I'm a dentist. This is the first foray by Adam Sandler into a serious kind of prestige piece. And the way this came about is Tom Cruise was on set at SNL when then wife
Katie Holmes?
No. The other one.
Nicole Kidman.
Nicole Kidman was hosting. While filming Magnolia, Anderson contacted Sandler through a phone call with Cruise and expressed his intention to make a film with him. And despite being unfamiliar with Anderson, Sandler agreed. Sandler was intimidated upon his first viewing of Magnolia, which is PTA's previous film.
Don't get Sean started on that one.
Don't get me started.
Quote, fucking terrified. And doubt his ability to carry Anderson's next film. Anderson helped alleviate his fears upon personally delivering the script. Sandler's casting was officially announced in November of 2000. In November of 2000, the unconventional pairing shocked reporters as Anderson was a filmmaker on the rise that wrote and directed critically acclaimed films, while Sandler was known for his negatively reviewed comedy romps, right? Like I said, this is the first time that Adam Sandler branched out into a serious role. You've got your Billy Madisons, you've got your Happy Gilmores, you've got all of that. So in the 1990s, or the 2000s rather, he did a serious movie every couple years. This movie was fairly well received. We got a 79% on Rotten Tomatoes. The website's critical consensus states, odd, touching, and unique. Punch Drunk Love is also delightfully funny, utilizing Adam Sandler's comic persona to explore the life of a lonely guy who finds love.
I remember this one fell through the cracks for me too, and I remember at the time thinking that I did not want to see Adam Sandler in a serious role about anger issues, which is kind of what my impression of it was.
Yeah, it is.
Now that we know what he's done with Uncut Gems and those other ones that you mentioned, it seems like maybe that was an unfair summation. So
I'm always rooting for him. Like, he's been wanting an Oscar since 2002.
As far as those comedy romps and gross out comedies go,
people want to see him.
His are better across the board than almost any other Saturday Night Live alum, save perhaps Chevy Chase.
Fuck Chevy Chase.
But National Lampoon's
whole other episode. All right, what do we got?
All right,
Sean,
I'm gonna close it out with a film from 1997 that goes to prove that in the 90s you could make a movie about anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking
the world was your oyster.
Oh my god! I mean, you have movies like Speed, you've got movies like Point Break, and then you've got this gem, Face Off,
which I also watched for the first time about a month ago.
A movie where they fucking get into a discussion about Face Off, Face Off. Oh my god, are you kidding me?
And in the opening scene, Nicolas Cage dressed as a priest dry humps a teenager.
Yep. Oh my god. Directed by John Woo, and don't get me fucking started on John goddamn Woo.
Would you say that when you describe his filmography, you would have two guns?
Jesus Christ. And I would twirl and somersault because that is part of gunplay. And then there would be a bunch of fucking...
And you'd hold it sideways.
I'd hold it sideways. And then there'd be a bunch of fucking doves that symbolize something that never get hit by stray bullets, by the way.
A lot of people don't that John Woo was responsible for the creation of Woo Girls. You're at a bar and you hear girls go, "Woo!"
He gets royalties.
It's a tribute to him.
Totally. I mean, hard-boiled, great. Fine. Give it credit for what it is.
Is it safe to say you didn't like this movie, Sean?
I'm getting there. But John Woo is the crutch master when it comes to directing. I'm sorry. The guy found something that people liked, and he leaned so fucking hard into it.
Did he do Broken Arrow?
Did he?
I don't know.
I'd have to look it up. All right, so... Starring John Travolta playing Sean Archer, which I thought was really funny. Archer! You've got Nicolas Cage playing Caster Troy with several meme-worthy shots, especially the giant eyeball.
And he has
thing.
A twin named Pollock, Caster and Pollock.
Yes.
Which is a reference.
Joan Allen playing the wife of John Travolta. Eve, Gina Gershon playing a love interest in the film. You got Fat Margaret Cho. And a bunch of other people, by the way, that are really interesting to point out. You have Thomas Jane in this film. Yeah. You've got Danny Masterson in this movie. You've got Joe Bob Briggs in this movie.
That was the one that surprised me. I was like, what the hell, Joe Bob Briggs?
He's like one of the doctors.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah, you've got John Carroll Lynch. You got Matt Ross. I mean, some really quality actors in this movie early in their careers. By the way, speaking of Danny Masterson, how fitting is it that Masterson tried to sexually assault Travolta's daughter in this movie?
Yep.
And now he's in prison for being a sex assaulter.
And he was recently transferred to another prison because the heat was on. There was a hit put out on him. He got fucking jumped in prison.
As he should be.
And injured. And then they put him into a more minimal security type deal where he's going to be safe. Mm. So, yeah. Anywho's.
With the other rapists.
Oh, this movie. Yeah, it's bonkers. There's no other word to describe it. Yeah, it's bonkers. You have a criminal and an FBI agent who are nemeses of each other, and they come up with this crazy plot to take his face off. So Travolta is going to assume the identity of Nicolas Cage to infiltrate Nicolas Cage's operation. Nicolas Cage wakes up, puts on Travolta's face, and kills everybody associated with it.
So nobody knows.
Yes. Travolta as Cage goes to super jail.
Yep.
And then
or where they have the lockdown boots.
The lockdown boots. The
lockdown boots need in my occupation. Oh, my I need those real bad.
The UGG boots of prison fashion. Yes.
The best part of this movie was that John Woo got John Travolta to say this ridiculous chin as part of his dialogue.
Yeah.
Chef's kiss. Yeah. There is a scene, of course, that towards the end of the film where the two of them, it's just the two of them. It's the big showdown.
Yep.
And there's a speedboat chase.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Dude, this, listen, this movie is so stupid, but it was
I'll get there. Nicolas Cage jumps onto the boat. I guess Nicolas Cage as Sean Archer jumps onto the boat and has a hard time getting his footing. That would have been the time to shoot him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's like a good 5 seconds where he's a prone target to shoot
him. Well, it's like those Kung Fu movies, though, where they try to fight, you know, Bruce Lee one at a time. Instead of, you know.
So anyway, those are some of the points about it. This movie was off the rails, crazy.
Yes.
I avoided it at the time. It was 97, so Allie was in grad school. And so when you're in grad school, you ain't got no money. You don't get to go see shit.
Mm-hmm.
And so it got...
I was a junior in high school.
Yeah, okay. Same, it got past me. I remember people watching it on VHS, and I'm like, I ain't watching this shit. And I will give the movie total credit. It's crazy. Yeah. It is so crazy. Fucking crazy.
You will not be bored watching this.
No, you can't be bored. It's full of problems. It's full of plot holes.
Of course.
He goes full Cage Rage.
You're talking about earlier about how you kind of had like these episodes where like, I'm not watching so-and-so's films. Cage and I went through this issue where I was not watching Cage movies, and this was probably the beginning of that point. But
now you're back on board.
I'm back on board. Yeah. I'm on the Cage train. It's crazy. I liked it. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
It is. You have to put all tethered
suspension of disbelief. Has
window. I'm saying any tethered to reality, you've just got to clip
because
that.
They only change faces. Like, wouldn't it have been smarter to have them change brains? But then you couldn't have called the film a face off. I'm sure somebody suggested that. Like in the producing room, they were like, "Hey, shouldn't
they?" Yeah, yeah. There's like a vocal cord,
the vocal thing,
thing,
but they don't have the same body though. Like John Travolta's like what maybe
this movie.
And y'all are already thinking too much about it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point. You can't think about it.
Don't think about it.
Nicolas Cage's Castor Troy as John Travolta hitting on Travolta's daughter. Just bizarro. Just uncomfortable. And just the performances were like at an 11.
Yeah.
Both of those guys were having fun with it.
They had to have been having a good blast.
I mean,
so
this is probably the first movie that started Nicolas Cage on the path to what we think of as Nicolas Cage.
Well, that's how you get Wicker Man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was like the first like step toward
but then also how you get the superior Mandy.
His journey into self-parody and then out of self-parody.
My favorite
here.
Shirt,
Joey.
That's my favorite
you.
Shirt.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Thank you.
Yep.
So yeah, that was one that definitely stayed in as a blind spot for me for many, many, many years. I knew what I was getting into. There were no real surprises other than somebody greenlit this project.
Yeah.
And that's what gave me pause. I was like, holy shit, they would make fucking anything in the 90s.
Just imagine someone pitching
movies
like this. I'm
going to go home and rewatch Face Off.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And that's the thing. It's a fun movie that...
Well, yeah, it goes back to the John Mulaney bit where he talks about just imagine someone pitching Back to the Future, you know, or something like that. Like,
this was 1997.
This guy goes back in time and tries to fuck his mom.
I reviewed this movie for the school newspaper at Clemson University. And I remember going to the Astro, which was then
$1.
Yeah,
dollar
there was
theater.
$1. Yeah, yeah.
God,
to watch it. And
Astro
I reviewed it.
Still intact.
I wish I could.
It's still there. It's still there. It's just sitting there.
There's nothing there.
Yeah, it's just sitting there empty.
I wish I could pull up that review, but I remember it being mostly positive, and my take on it was a lot like Sean's, that it was ridiculous, but thoroughly entertaining.
Yeah, I cannot... any misgivings I might have about the movie, it's just... It's crazy.
Yeah.
And
Joey,
it's fun.
I'm realizing right now that there's the entirely real possibility that you and I were in the at the same time.
Wow.
Watching movies.
You would have been like, what, 16?
Did you see...
I saw Higher Learning there.
What about...
I saw Screamers there.
What about Devil's Advocate? Did you watch that there?
Don't think so, but it is possible. I think I saw How High there, maybe.
Advocate. No, it's not Devil's Advocate. Okay, all right. We're spinning out of control. Yeah. We're gonna wrap
just
it up.
Like the movie we just discussed.
Exactly. Look what happens when you bring up Face Off. Things get crazy. All right. So that was a lot of fun going over our crazy blind spots. Travis, I'm sorry that you've seen all the movies and your blind spots were a little bit more niche.
Are they niche?
A little bit.
That Punch Drunk Love was good one.
Punch Drunk Love, you guys have never.
I've never seen it.
I'd really seen it. Yeah.
And you as a PTA acolyte, that was pretty.
That's interesting.
Yeah. That was an oversight.
That's a great one. I've never seen Casablanca, by the way. So we could do a second episode where I have to add my hat to that, and we'll talk about it again.
Do you guys want to arm wrestle for the picture, the poster there? All right.
No, Joey's getting that.
Joey's getting it.
He's seen it now, so I'm the only one left in the group.
All right, so that's going to be it for tonight. We're going to be on hiatus for about 3 weeks, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to do our Razzies episode.
In 3 weeks?
Yeah, it's at the end of March.
Sweet.
I got somewhere to go.
Is it March 29th?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
That's my birthday.
Sweet. Nice. I'll bake you a cake. We're going to do a Razzies episode. We're going to talk about the deserving and sometimes undeserving films that have been awarded Razzies for Worst Picture. Please follow us on social media. We're Cinema Chop Shop everywhere except for YouTube, which we are known as Cinema Chop Shop Podcast. You can listen to and watch a video presentation of this podcast, which is weird.
But you don't have to actually see us.
No.
You don't actually have to actually watch it.
No, you can just listen.
Listen to it.
So until next time, love yourself and love your family. And
tell your friends you love them.
Please do.
Love you guys.
I love all of you guys so much. And please remember to watch
Shop
Retrofit.